Ben-Gavir came to me and said to me, he came very close, and then he said to me, "You are a terrorist, and you will be treated as a terrorist in the coming days." And so I got up and I said to him that he's a coward.
Just that moment, right?
Yeah.
Here, you look and you see Ben-Gavir.
I was like, what the, you know?
You can say it.
It's like, what the fuck?
Surely by now, we've all seen and heard of the Gaza flotillas, the civilian ships that set sail through international waters in an attempt to break Israel's siege on Gaza and deliver aid. Now, each mission brought together a global coalition of volunteers, from activists to media workers to public figures, who all wanted to shed light on Israel's genocide and its blocking of humanitarian aid. Today, I'm sitting down with Yasmin Ajar, a leading activist from Germany and a member of the Global Sumud Flotilla Steering Committee. When the flotilla's 42 boats were intercepted in international waters this October, those on board were immediately taken in by Israeli forces, held in prison, and later deported. Many have since spoken about being physically and psychologically tortured, denied food and medicine, and stripped of their basic rights while in Israeli custody. In this conversation, Yasmin gives her first media testimony of what she endured and witnessed inside Israel's prisons. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk.
Yasmin Ajar, thank you so much for coming on Real Talk.
Thank you for having me.
No, absolutely. Listen, I know you have so much going on, so I really appreciate you taking the time to come and sit. But let's actually, you know, let's just start there, Yasmin. You know, it's been, what, three weeks since you've come back?
Yes.
From Israel?
Yes.
From being detained. I want to ask, before we even get into all these details, I want to ask you about how the last few weeks have been since your imprisonment, since you got out, since you went back to Germany, and now you're doing a whole bunch of other activities on the side. But how have you been processing all of this?
Well, I mean, since I've been back, I mean, a lot of things have happened, especially politically. You know, when we arrived, they announced the ceasefire.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of things are happening politically, but also for us activists. Being back is, you know, this was my second imprisonment in Israel since June,
right.
4 months, right?
Because you're on two flotillas this summer.
Right, yeah. Right. And it's been very intense. So, you know, coming back, I mean, I didn't rest much because the work continues. And so I've been traveling a lot. I've been doing a lot of advocacy work and, you know, meeting up with different organizations, with activists, you know, seeing how we can further, you know, help Palestine, mm-hmm. you know, to liberate Palestine, mm-hmm. basically. And, you know, you know, after the ceasefire, we have been seeing how many Palestinians are continuing to be killed.
It's been violated. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's been violated many times. So, the flotillas, we don't stop. You know, we're going there and then being detained and then coming home. Our work doesn't stop there, so it continues. So that's why I've been working intensely.
Mm. You know, I want to delve into everything that's happened, and I you're going to be my guide because I don't want to, you know, I don't want you to say anything you don't want to say or get too intense, but. I do want to start here asking about the, you know, right after the flotilla got intercepted, the Sumud flotilla that you were on, right? Just a few weeks ago. From that moment to the moment of you being taken in, can you just walk us through what happened?
Well, I mean, the Sumud flotilla, right? Everyone was watching. It was, we initially planned to sail 15 days. But then, you know, it took us over a month to, you know, to the point where we got intercepted. And we had many, many different challenges from, you know, technical issues.
Tunis as well.
Yes, in Tunis. And then we had, you know, the weather conditions were very harsh because it was the end of the sailing season.
Yeah.
We knew this. So, you know, and then being bombed, you know, in Tunis. Which set us back, and then continuing and then being bombed again in international waters, and then to the point where we got intercepted. And then eventually the interception, you know, as the world saw, I mean, we were 42 boats,
yes,
462 activists at sea in international waters, and then being brutally intercepted. There was obviously it was violent. Some of them were violent.
Can we talk about that? So as soon as the Israeli forces came on the boats, what happened? Because I know that there's a protocol, and yes, we've seen it on the stream this time, but we've also seen it on previous flotillas as well, that there's a particular protocol that the activists on board, the people on board, kind of follow. They raise their hands, and you know, I guess it's something that they go through training. But from your experience on this specific one, as soon as the Israeli forces came on board, do the soldiers know, like, a lot of the people on board? Like, are they able to immediately identify who you are and know?
Well, yeah, you know.
Or does it, by the time you get to Ashdod, that's when the identification happens?
Well, with that many people, they don't know. It's impossible for them to know, right, the 462 people. Sure. On the Madleen, they...
But you're a known face.
Right. They approach me by my name. They approach, you know, others as well by their name, like Mandela or Greta or Tiago, you know. They approach us by our name. And right, they always speak to us, you know, calling us by our name, and to kind of create this, like, we know each other, you know, to create this, like, like, we know each other, like, to be more comfortable with them. I don't know. But obviously they cannot be trusted, right? And you know, when you get to Ashdod, when you're mm-hmm. close to Ashdod, they change immediately. And it's actually really insane to see the switch, because they act very nice.
Okay.
And it's an act. You can, and not all of them, by the way, right? I mean, there are some soldiers, they were brutal, you know, beating people. And I was also, like, you know, there were times where I wasn't treated right.
On the boat?
Yes. Like,
what happened?
But when we got close to Ashdod, and this, okay, yeah. So when you get close to Ashdod, it's like, there's a switch.
It's like you're in Israeli territory, or like,
exactly. And this is when they switch, and this is when you can see how brutal they are. You know, I've been handcuffed. I've been called names, and some of them even, you know, made comments on, you know, like, there were sexual comments, you know, and
towards you.
Yes, and this happened with during the Madleen as well, and so.
Sexual comments. Forgive me here, but sexual comments in the sense of, like, we're gonna do this to you, something like that.
They haven't told me, but they said to others,
okay,
even to men. They told men that they were gonna, you know, do this and that to them, in a sexual way.
Right.
Me personally, they didn't do that to me personally, but there were sexual comments, like, here and there, you know, how men like to do it. So yeah, I mean, fast forward to Ashdod, they then give you over to the police, and mind you, the police is controlled by Ben-Gvir, and mm-hmm. we all know who Ben-Gvir is. And
there was a video from Ashdod that Ben-Gvir yes. filmed.
Yes.
Where he was looking at the volunteers and the activists from the flotilla, and he called them terrorists.
Well, I have a good story for you there. So we were, I was actually shocked to see it, because even though the, we were intercepted first, but then some boats made it as close as 20 nautical miles. So one boat, Mykonos boat, actually managed to break the illegal siege. They were in Palestinian territorial water.
I think that was a record. That was a record for the boats.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
It was the first boat to actually reach that far.
Yes. Well, I mean, not the first boat in the history of the Freedom Flotilla.
No, no. I meant from just since the genocide began.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. It was the first boat to make it that close during the genocide. But yeah, so when we got there, Alma, we were then also taken to this area where everyone was kneeling down. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in the last row. Basically, this was the entrance. You have everyone sitting here, and I was sitting in the last row. You know, even getting there was horrific, because they would use violence to, you know, they dragged me out from the boat. I first had handcuffs, very tight handcuffs. And then they opened these handcuffs and brought me there, like, you know, took me by my neck and, like, you know, they took, they push you down so you can't, you can barely walk. And so, and then they sat me down, and as I'm, and I had to, you know, I wasn't allowed to look, but I wanted to make sure that, because we had elderly people with us as well, and I wanted to make sure that they're fine. So I was looking to my right and left and asking people quietly if they're okay. And so, and when I turned to my right, you know, to look at my comrade and ask her if she's okay, I saw from the side that someone is coming in, and you could tell that there's someone important coming in because of all the security. And then I was like, screw it, I'm just going to look. So I looked back, and this is when I saw Ben-Gvir. And
just that moment right here, you look and you see Ben-Gvir.
How was that? How?
Just before we even get into what he said and what everybody was experiencing, you look and you see Ben-Gvir. What goes through your mind?
I was like, what the, you know?
You can say it.
It's like, what the fuck? You know, is this a joke? And, you know, it's just like seeing this man, like this monster right behind you. I couldn't even... I my mind was just like running and like at a speed, like I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand, like, I felt, you would think you feel like rage or like some kind, like that feeling is just like, I don't know what kind of feeling that was. It was a mixture of everything, as well as shock, you know. So when I saw him, I said to my comrade, there was someone sitting in front of me. I turned around and looked, and I was like, we can't allow this. We cannot, because I knew what was going to happen. I knew that he was going to come, try to speak to us, and like exactly what he, you know, what you saw then. And I said, we can't allow this. So I started chanting. And I had a shirt on, and I did this with the Madeline as well, because when we were brought to Ashdod, like leaving the boat, we are not allowed to have any Palestinian symbols or like any, you know, like no kufiya, no pins, no nothing. We're not allowed. And with the Madeline, to protest that, I wrote with a marker "Free Palestine" on my T-shirt, and I let my hair down, and I put my backpack on. And so the soldiers would not see it. And when I then stepped foot on Palestinian soil, I took my backpack off, put my hair up, and then I, with Madeline, I turned around to the cameras, because obviously there's so many cameras. So
to
I turned
show
around.
What you wrote.
Yes, I did the same thing with the Sumud as well, because I knew already that they were not going to allow our kafiyas. So I did the same, and when Ben-Gvir came, I put my hair up, and I sat up, and then I showed him, and I chanted "Free Palestine," and, you know, I called him a baby killer. And this is when the security, all of them, they came, and then
obviously this wasn't in his video.
No, that one was not, because that was the beginning.
Yeah.
And when we started chanting, everyone started chanting. Like the whole
but you
crowd,
started it, basically.
The whole crowd like started chanting, and so and in the video, I don't know if you saw it, you could still hear everyone chanting. So there was, imagine, they had no video of us not chanting, so that's why they had to post something, but you could still hear the chants. So we didn't give him that, you know, quiet where he can come and treat us as terrorists and like talk is like, you know, nonsense.
But what was the reaction when you started chanting?
Well, I think there was like a shock, because they came to me and they looked at me. They were like, be quiet, be quiet. And I was like, no, I'm not going to be quiet. And then I stood up. And this is when they came and grabbed me by the neck. Like, there were like many like police officers. They surrounded me and they grabbed me by my arms and by my neck. And then they threw me down. And then they just basically dragged me out. And then start beating me.
Started beating you?
Yes.
This is immediately after this, after the chant?
Yes. Yes, because I wouldn't, I just, while they were carrying me, dragging me out, I was still like, you know, I actually started making a political statement, telling them that, you know, that they're committing a genocide, that they're starving people, that they're killing babies, and that there will be an end to Israel. And they didn't like it.
Well,
obviously they're not going to like it, right?
you don't let up, huh? You don't let up. I mean, it's just obviously I'm taken in by your whole experience here. I'm not trying to make light of it at all, but it's just so.
No, we have to. It's totally fine.
Yeah, but it's also even listening to you describe it, and you know, there's people that are taken in. There's, you know, there's the far right, you know, national security ministers coming in, and there's a very dark mood here, and yet you are not letting go. You feel like you have a mission, and you want to protest, and you want to make a statement, and you're facing Israeli forces, and yet you were saying these things. So that's why I said that you don't let up. But when you said they beat you, like as in with their hands, did they use like
feet,
sticks,
hands,
or feet,
everything.
Hands? Okay.
So what they did, they immediately put handcuffs on me again. And so I had my hands, they put my handcuffs like this, and then they pulled me up from the handcuffs. So obviously I did at some point think they're going to dislocate my shoulders, because it was so brutal the way they did it. But I didn't stop, because for me, look, you don't stop advocating when you have the monster standing in front of you, because this is what we are, you know, protesting. This is what, you know, this is what we're telling the world, that these are criminals. And then you have the criminal right in front of you. Why would I stop? This is the moment to tell him straight to his face, right? So, and also, what are they going to do? I mean, what are they going to do? Kill me? And then what? There are millions of me out there. You know, I'm really not scared of, I'm neither scared of death. I'm not scared of death. Neither am I scared to stand up for what I believe is right. So I don't, you know. Yeah, like I said, like, what are they going to do?
But how did the beating, like, when did they stop physically assaulting you and physically beating you?
Well, it never, like, I mean, when they took me, when they realized I'm not going to stop, I mean, I was brought to, like, where there were many cameras, soldiers were still there, police officers, as much as I could see, because they pushed me down, and then they had me kneel down, and then they took my neck, and then, like, started to, like, like take my head and like, you know, jam, like smash it to the ground every time I try to put my head up, because for me it's important to always keep my head up. And so, and each time they tried to do that, each time I tried to put my head up, they smashed it to the ground, and then they start kicking me, to my sides, and then, you know, and then like using their hands. I can't tell you exactly. This is so many things happened in that moment. Obviously, there was a lot of adrenaline.
Yeah,
but I do remember like the kicking and with their hands and with their feet, and then also like trying to smash my head to the ground each time.
And were you removed from the group basically?
Immediately. Okay. And then I was brought inside. I was basically dragged inside to the Ashdod, like this huge hall. And in on the sides of the hall, they have like small like fitting room, kind of small spaces to undress and everything. So then I was given over to the women. And women are very brutal. They started beating
soldiers.
Me. Yes, not soldiers, but officers.
Officers, okay.
And they started beating me again. And then they told me to. They immediately wanted to take my shirt off, and I told them I'm not going to take my shirt off. And they start shouting and then start like trying to take it off of me, and you know, like many things, like you know, like. Like you're standing at the wall, like they put me to the wall, you know, like facing the wall. And then they say, open your legs. And my legs are open because they want to, like, you know, strip search me. And my legs are like wide open, but they're still kicking my legs. So, you know, I continuously, like I fall down because it's, I mean, they want me to make a split, you know. And I'm like, my legs are open. Like, it's not, like, why are you kicking it? Why are you kicking me? So obviously I would constantly fall, and then they would slam me back to the door, to the wall. And then they started, you know, like pulling my hair and then stripping me completely naked and like making fun of me, you know, and calling me really bad names and asking, telling me how dare I, and if it wasn't enough the first time when I came there, and now it's going to get worse for me.
So at this point, they identified you. They knew
you'd
come here before. They knew
yes, you. I even saw officers that I knew from the first time.
Oh,
yeah.
You recognize someone.
Yes, I am very good at recognizing faces, and I made sure that I keep track of the faces.
After what you just described about being beaten, about being strip searched, and then being recognized as well, what happens after that?
Well, I mean, then you go through the process, meaning you go through interrogation, you go through them taking pictures of you, taking your fingerprints, forcing you to sign some kind of papers, and basically threatening you. For me, it's different for everyone. Like, for example, we had American citizens, but Jewish American citizens. They're being treated differently. Then you have, Middle Eastern people. You have North Africans. Everyone is treated differently, judging from their profile, and obviously. Zionism is based on, racism. It's a racist ideology. And they do have a problem with Muslims, And so you can tell how they were treating Muslims and how they were treating Europeans.
And you're of a Muslim background.
Yes. So there's, and with me, it was like, because they recognized me, and then there's this one officer, he knew that I was from Germany. Which I explained to him. I was like, look, he was like, you're German. And I was like, well, I was born in Germany, but, and he was like, yeah, but you're not German. And I was like, but then he continued, but he was like, but you are from Germany and it's your country who committed the real genocide. And then I asked him, I was like, okay, so there's like an unreal and real genocide, like a genocide is a genocide. And I said, and because Germany has done it, doesn't justify your genocide, So, and he continued like trying to, like he just like, made like these, like, just like trying to piss me off, And my lawyer was sitting next to me and she was like, don't let him piss you off.
So there was a lawyer.
Yes. We are working with with Adala.
Yeah.
And Adala is a Palestinian led, yeah. So they are there to welcome us and to help us out with the interrogation. And so I had my lawyer and she was also like, she was like telling him, like, why are you speaking to her like that? She even had to stop him because he was like after me and, he would just insult me and he would just say really insane things and mainly, there is no Palestine, welcome to Israel.
But what you're saying about the racism. It's similar to a conversation I've had. So Chris Smalls was on the show this summer after he went back to the U.S. And he was speaking about how he was treated differently because he was the only African-American. I think he was only one of two people of color on his boat when mm-hmm. he was taken in. And mm-hmm. he was subjected to racism. And he says that a large part of the beatings that he received was because of the fact that he was Black.
Yeah.
And so you saw racism firsthand as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A woman with a hijab, they were forced to take off their hijabs. I mean, I tried to stop it with everything. I really tried. I was fighting them to give these women their hijab. And they were laughing. They were like, they were trying to humiliate Muslims with everything they had, like everything they could use to humiliate people. They used it, especially with Muslim women. And of course we know stories about Muslim men, people of color, they were also like people of color. They're just being mistreated, especially if they're Muslim, especially when they have a hijab on. And then also, Palestinians, we have Palestinians with us from Europe as well. And of course, they go for Palestinians first, right? Palestinians are always treated much worse than anyone. But
even those with Western passports.
Of course, they, you know, when you look at, you know, I'm from Germany and I'm from Berlin. It's the biggest Palestinian diaspora in Europe. And the way the state is treating Palestinians, and even prior to 7th of October, is horrific. You know, a lot of them, for example, they're stateless. They remain stateless for 20 years. You know, and what does that mean? You're not able to travel, really. You know, your job situation, everything. It affects your whole life. And why are they doing that? When, for example, Ukrainians came, I mean, we know how the world treated them, right? But for Palestinians, it's not the same. It has never been the same. It has always been dehumanizing and discriminatory, you know. And
you're someone who dealt with Ukrainian refugees because you created you founded the Berlin Arrival Support.
Yes.
Which is a volunteer-based group that helped Ukrainian refugees when Russia invaded a few years back.
Yeah.
When they arrived to Germany. I think it was like 15,000 volunteers that were involved. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I started the very next day because, you see, you can call me human rights activist, you can call me humanitarian, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm just a human. I don't believe in borders. For me, it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter if you're white, black, you know, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you are a human. So the center of my activism, the center of everything for me is humanity. So I did exactly the same things for Ukrainians that I'm doing now for Palestinians, and which I have done for Syrians, for Afghani refugees, you know. It doesn't matter. But
the media was kinder to you in Germany.
Absolutely, because you know, when we say that human rights are non-negotiable, but apparently they are, and that's what we have been seeing. That is what Palestinians have been living through, you know. For decades and decades, just that no one was listening to them. And we have to, you know, this is what I always talk about, that it seems like that human rights are negotiable and that humanitarian, like international law is negotiable, apparently. And that, you know, some deserve to live and some, you know, some just don't. You know, Muslim, Arab, Black lives are expandable. This is how the world treats these people. This is how the world treats us. Because when bombs fall in the Middle East, you know, white people or Europeans, they just think, oh, yeah, well, I mean, it looks good. You know, this is always what's happening there. It's being normalized. Violence is being normalized when it's, you know, when violence is done on black, brown bodies, Arab, Muslim bodies, you know.
Yeah, that region always has conflict. There's always conflict in that region. They're always fighting each other one way or another.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then they come, and which we have seen, you know, like since I'm back at these peace talks. Like, war criminals are not eligible or like don't have the luxury to speak of peace. They just don't. You cannot bomb a whole region into peace. And me personally, I'm never going to accept that. I'm never going to be quiet about these racist systems that, you know, that exists very much everywhere, you know. And this is why Israel, you know, Israel can get, well, I mean, they're not getting away with people, but this impunity that they're enjoying, why is it? Because they believe that they're the only democracy in the Middle East. Please.
Before we move on from this, because I want to get you're touching on it right now, but your advocacy and your involvement with Ukrainian refugees and the way, like I said, the media was kinder to you in Germany because of how you're involved. But what has it taught you, I guess, about the double standards when you started advocating for Palestinians?
I've always advocated for Palestinians. Mm. You know, I mean, it's not new. But obviously after 7th of October, everyone who knew the story or the history of Palestine knew that this is it. They are going to mass slaughter. And so obviously, you know, we started working much more intense, you know, like much more intensely. And the double standards, I mean, everyone knows about it. It's not the first time. I mean, you know, when I was, for example, when I was helping Ukrainians, you know, I was helping the Berlin Senate. I was a part of the crisis committee of the Senate. So I was advising them on how to deal with the crisis that they have created. And I would also speak to them about the discrepancies and the different treatment in refugees. You know, I would speak about, like, you know, that you know, Afghani, Syrian, and so many other refugees are being treated differently, and how so?
Than Ukrainians,
obviously. And they didn't like it. I even with the media, I always spoke about it. I also spoke about Palestine during that time as well. And I would tell them that what they're doing is selective empathy. They're showing selective empathy, and that this is not the way to go. So I've always spoken out about that.
I want to go back to your time in prison before you came back to Germany. So, because it was really good to kind of delve into what we just delved into, but I want to make sure that there's nothing that we left out from that story. Because is it true that Ben-Gvir spoke to you at some point?
Yes. Ben-Gvir came to me and said to me, he came very close, and then he said to me, "You are a terrorist, and you will be treated as a terrorist in the coming days." And I stood up because I was sitting down, and so I got up and I said to him that he's a coward, and that we will hunt him down, and that he's a baby killer. And that the world is not going to look away. And then he called me again terrorist. And I said again, "And you are a coward." And that is when he kind of, like, he just rushed out and he left immediately. And they filmed it. They were filming everything.
And then what happened?
And then they continued with their interrogation. I was sitting there at a table like this.
And you didn't know
I had someone in front of me. What's that?
And you didn't know he was coming.
No.
It was another surprise, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw him coming and then he looked at me. Like, I could tell, like, that he was probably looking for me, because he was, like, looking and then asking people. And then there was one person who pointed at me. And then he came around and then he stopped right next to me. And that's when he called me, you know, terrorist, and that I will be treated like a terrorist.
And you felt immediately that you needed to talk back.
And I told him that he's because, you know, the Israel, like, and you can tell with everyone there, that they have the sense of arrogance. They really truly believe that what they're doing is right. They truly believe that there is no genocide. They truly believe that they are not starving children. They truly believe that a baby in a mother's womb is a terrorist. They truly believe all of these things. They are in this bubble of, like, pure terror. They are surrounded by violence. And the only reason they are surrounded by violence is because they are bringing the violence, you know. I don't think I could be a violent person because I don't feel violence inside of me. Because this is not how I feel when I look at human beings, you know. So you really, really have to hate something so much to believe that the violence that you're bringing is not violence, that it's a righteous thing, that this is what they deserve. So... And when you have someone like that in front of you, I mean, obviously, I'm not going to sit down and let him talk to me like that. Not because I'm taking it personal. He can say whatever to me. I'm not taking it personal. Mm. But for the Palestinians, to let him know that we see what they're doing and that the Palestinian population is not alone. Because, you know, Palestinians cannot, I mean, how many times, like, you know, when you look at these videos and you literally see how these men are being treated and the way you can literally tell that the occupation, that they cannot talk back, they cannot say things. So, and I think when you have a people that are being so oppressed that they cannot voice certain things, then it is your duty to speak up for them. Mm. You have to. I used all of my privilege, you know, being from Europe, having a strong passport. I used that privilege to speak for the Palestinians.
And that was basically the last eventful thing that happened before you were deported.
Yes.
You know, you're talking about using your privilege, but that doesn't come without a price, having these views, taking these actions, going through everything that you've been through. You know, where is Yasmin today? Because there is a price to pay for speaking the way you speak, acting the way you act.
Mm. Where am I today, as in legally, like what, like
in terms of just you in life, in terms of you and the repercussions of your actions? I mean where are you? Because you're still living in Germany, so
yes, I mean, anywhere, it doesn't matter where I I'm at. It doesn't, it, like, what matters is that anything that I go through is never what the oppressed are going through. Yes, there's oppression in Germany, obviously, you know. Yes, there are many injustices, you know, many things that have happened to me that are just not right. But at the end of the day, I'm still privileged. Like, I'm sitting here and I don't have to fear bombs. I can go home, you know, and eat and drink and not worry, you know. I can sleep without, you know, thinking, oh, when is a missile going to hit my building, you know. So that's what I always remind myself of. Yes, I could, you know, sit in a corner and cry about everything that I've lost, but it's nowhere near what others are losing, because they're losing their lives. You know, I'm not losing my life. I'm using certain privileges, like a job, like, you know.
But you say that as if it's something small. I mean,
It's not small, but it's not small if your life is all about work. If your life is built around money and, you know, the things that you material want to own, you know. My life has never been built on these things. My life has never been built on money and what I own and what I want in life. My life has been, you know, I like to... You know, like, a humble life is a good life, you know? And I consider myself a very rich woman for the things I feel towards humanity. I think, you know, you can have a lot of richness inside of yourself, you know? And then the people that I'm surrounded with, I'm very fortunate. I'm a very fortunate woman. And I don't take these things for granted. And losing a job, yes, you know, losing a job or not being able to work, it's not only a loss, but it also shows me that I am on the right path, you know. Why would they not allow me to work? Why would they be after me? Why would the lobby do everything and anything in their power to cancel me? Because truth has this uncomfortable thing that it stays, you know. And they are uncomfortable with that. They are uncomfortable with the fact that truth is here to stay. And they understand that if they cancel me, if they do all of these things to me, it's not going to stop. Because I'm not the one, like, making this movement. I'm not the one, you know, I'm not the only one talking. There are millions of people around the world, and especially Palestinians. You know, screw me. Palestinians know the truth. And finally, the world is listening to them. they have to do more than just listening, obviously. But then also, at what cost is the world listening to them? But yeah.
So what's next for Yasmin?
For me, I'm just continue what I've been doing.
You still don't want to stop, huh, after all this?
But like, what does stopping mean? I mean, what does it mean? Like, I don't know, like having a job and, you know, being in this cycle of, you know, capitalist, like, you know, in this cycle of capitalism, you know, I mean, what is happening is, you know, the reason for it is global capitalism, you know, everyone is profiting from the suffering of others. And when Palestine is free, doesn't mean that the rest is free. The West is imposing so much violence on the global South, and the fight against, you know, colonialism, imperialism, has to continue. And no, I'm not going to stop. I mean, it's just, you know, I made a promise when I was very young. That when I was young, I thought I will change the world. And then, you know, I realized, you know, growing up, I was like, okay, maybe, you know, I have to just like, you know, start in small steps. And then eventually, you know, it will spark others, you know. And so this is not something, I haven't been thinking or feeling like this since 2 years. I've always been that person. I've always been this person. And for me, justice, you know, my heart burns for justice. Yes. And it's a part of me. So it's not something that I can stop, you know.
And we're going to leave it here. Yasmin Ajjar, honestly, this was such a heavy but important conversation. And thank you for stopping by. Thank you for opening up. Mm-hmm. And thank you for letting us know what happened over the last, you know, 6-7 weeks with you and beyond. So thanks for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It's been great.